right. We're doing some counter programming tonight here, folks. It's not often that I say I won't see a movie, but it's not that I'll never watch Godzilla X Kong New Empire. It's just that it's at the very, very back of the queue. I've learned my lesson from the other legendary movies that, I can't get behind just watching giant monsters beat the crap out of each other for 2.5 hours. It's kind of the same thing with the Transformers movies. They might be wonderful. I know, Mark, you love these films. And, you know, Katie Glidewell loves them, too. You guys had a great live stream the other night, which I still have to catch up with. So, yes, there is a lot of appreciation to go around. I just don't happen to be one of those folks. So, in respect to Godzilla, we're going to do something a little different tonight. We're going to do Godzilla X Godzilla, or should I say Gojira X Godzilla King of the Monsters. Yes, we're traveling back to 1954 and 1956, respectively, to look at a film that is 70 years old this year, and a movie that's 70 or 68 years old, I guess. I can't do math. I went to art college. But yeah, we're going to talk about it. I'm pleased to be joined by two very dear friends, Mark the Movie Man Krawcheck of Special Mark Productions and the Spoiler Room Podcast, of which I'm a guest most Mondays. And Bill Goodmanson, the resin chef himself of Bill's Kitchen, or as he's known tonight, International Judas. Bill, I think you are the biggest Godzilla fan that I know. Mark, you might be the second biggest Godzilla fan that I know. So getting you guys together to talk about it, I had to have the experts on to guide me through this experience. First of all, Bill, how you doing?
Very good.
Mark, how are you doing? I breezed right over you.
it's quite all right. I'm doing good too.
Excellent. I'm doing great because, as I think I mentioned on the lead up / tease to last week's show, I've never seen Godzilla all the way through. I think I'd seen bits of it when I was a kid. My dad was more into like Gamera. He had a fascination with Gamera for some reason, but I'd never watched Godzilla. And Bill, this is a bit of a story from a few years ago. You actually gave me your Criterion Collection Blu-ray of
that's
Godzilla.
That's beautiful. Yeah, that one's beautiful.
It is nice.
Yeah.
So
I did a great job. That is like the best. Transfer. They got rid of a lot of negative dust. The picture is just as better than anything that I've ever seen. That's the Blu-ray, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I gave that to you because I got the big set, and that has the same disc in it. So.
So, did you get the? Is it a 4K set, or was it like just a big Blu-ray set of all the movies, or something?
Blu-ray.
Okay. Because, yeah, I was watching this. This looks great. So we're going to I pulled this thing off the shelf and I decided to watch it. And it's odd because I had to look for the 1956 version of Godzilla. It's actually listed as a special feature on the disc. It's not like because they have both versions of the film on there, but it's not like you put in the disc and it loads up. Oh, watch this or this. No, it's you watch Godzilla. If you want to watch Godzilla King of the Monsters, you gotta dig. And dig I did to find Raymond Burr starring as, I mean, right off the bat, his name's Steve Martin. I mean, that didn't mean anything to anybody in 1956, but to me, I couldn't not think of the famous comic actor. But I actually watched these movies in, I think, the perfect order. And that is I watched Godzilla King of the Monsters, the Americanized, bastardized version. And then I went back and I watched the Ishiro Honda original classic. Mm-hmm. Now, I say that's the right way to watch it because I feel like if I had watched the 54 Godzilla first, I don't know that I would have made it through the 56 version. I might have even like destroyed / burned, blown up that beautiful Blu-ray that you lent me, Bill, or gave to me. Because it's an abomination. But watching the abomination first, I kind of knew what was going on. I'd heard the things like, oh, they just took the 54 version and did all these inserts with Raymond Burr awkwardly. And you can totally tell. Mm-hmm. But it's so funny and out of place. But what I didn't pick up on was there are so many other characters in the movie that we just get like glimpses of and passing mentions of, or like, you know, clips here and there. They're the main characters of the original film. So going to watch Godzilla 54, I was completely, you know, my mind was blown away. It was like the Stargate from 2001. I'm like, wait a second, this lovely, beautiful monologue by the doctor at the end of the film about, you know, what if there are other Godzillas and H-bomb radiation, you know, atomic radiation, all that stuff. What have we wrought, essentially? In the 56 version, you get Raymond Burr with a voiceover saying, well, we defeated Godzilla. And you get a quick shot of the doctor from that speech, just kind of looking forlorn, I think, right before he was ready to talk. I'm like, wow, that was definitely a decision. So, Bill, I want to start with you. Give me, if you can, biggest Godzilla fan, a condensed version of, when did you first watch Godzilla? Was Godzilla 54, was that your first Godzilla, or did you come to other movies in the series and then kind of work your way back to it? And what was it about this movie or this series that really captured your imagination?
The first one that I saw was, they used to have something here in Chicago called the 3:30 movie. Mm. It was on from 3:30 in the afternoon to 5:00 in the afternoon. And, they used to, sometimes they would do theme weeks. I remember there was a monster week that I saw once that had such gems as Reptilicus in it. And,
nice.
But at one point, I had no idea what I was looking for, and I stumbled upon the 1964 movie, Mothra versus Godzilla, which was called Godzilla versus the Thing in the United States, perhaps because the idea of Godzilla and Mothra didn't sound scary enough, not that it's a scary movie or anything. Although from the trailer, and I tuned in just sort of as Godzilla was coming out of the ground after being washed ashore by this hurricane. And I loved, at that time, I loved dinosaurs and I loved insects. And it was like, okay, but that kind of fell back until I think 1969 when I was 9 years old and they released Destroy All Monsters in the theaters. Me and a couple of my friends were dropped off by my dad at, I believe it was the Wilmette Theater, and just left there, you know, on our own, being told that we'd be picked up at such and such a time. And you're just like free range kids, just seeing movies. And that thing, it had all these monsters. It was super colorful. It was total fun. And that put the hook in me. Mm. I didn't see the original, or I didn't see Godzilla King of the Monsters until, it's hard to judge time back then, but, you know, maybe a year later when it was on TV, and it didn't really hit me, do that much for me at the time. I mean, it was like, yeah, this is Godzilla, but it's kind of weird. And, you know, I had seen like a couple of other ones like Ghidra, the three-headed monster again, which is like really colorful and crazy and, you know, has monster talking to each other scenes. And so it kind of, then I saw it a few other times, but it really wasn't until, there was some point in the early 80s when the Art Institute showed the original Godzilla.
Ooh, nice.
And I got to see it on a big screen in their theater there. Unfortunately, there was like a 5-minute cut of like the rampage through Tokyo. So like I'm watching it and I'm going like, oh, wait a minute. And that's when I really got to know and really enjoy the beginning of all this stuff.
So you saw King of the Monsters and then you saw Godzilla.
Well, I think like pretty much everybody in the United States at that time, there was no way to see the original one. Mm-hmm. Even we used to have correspondents in Japan, and they would send us beta tapes taken off of TV.
Nice.
Japanese TV. We get these great Japanese commercials in the middle that were just unintelligible, but like no subtitles or anything. Mm. So until you see it with the subtitles and you realize, like well, there's a lot more going on in this movie than what we were used to. And since then, I don't know, I've seen this one probably more than in the others because there's been a lot of screenings of it. When we had the 50th anniversary, they had it at the Music Box for a week or two. And then there's a show called G-Fest that pops up every July here. And they've shown it in theaters a few times. I mean, I think I've seen like half a dozen different variations on the subtitles. And most of them agree with each other. A couple of them, for some reason, have decided to throw the F word in there. Where normally it's just sort of like, you know, somebody saying damn, which probably, I can't say for sure, but probably is more accurate.
Certainly
pull you out of the movie the way that.
Well, it's like that scene in the 1986 animated Transformers, the movie, where they have some swear words. They say damn and shit.
Yep.
Yeah. 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 But I mean, it was a little kid about to be eaten by a giant monster, a planet eating monster. Maybe it was his dad. I can't remember. But anyway, yeah, I mean, that's the weird thing is like watching Godzilla King of the Monsters and then finding out, did you know that there was this Japanese version out there before you started kind of corresponding with your friends and they got sent it to you and there was a revelation? Was it disappointing to see that there was a whole other movie with out Raymond Burr? I mean, because they are two completely different movies. I mean, Gojira is a straight up dark science fiction love triangle meets science drama. And then King of the Monsters is just, I mean, they might as well have had Steve Martin because it's just so funny and weird.
I don't think, I disagree. I don't think that King of the Monsters is that bad. It doesn't hold a candle to the original one, but I think that for what they were doing at the time was probably the only way that that movie would have gotten released in the United States. It did get released. It was shown in some theaters, Japanese theaters in, I think, in San Francisco and Los Angeles, maybe in Hawaii in the 50s. But that, you know, would never have, never would have caught on. And I think that the whole Godzilla thing would not have caught on in the United States without the Raymond Burr version.
I agree that it's important. And, you know, historically, I mean, you're talking about something that happened, you know, 9 years after Hiroshima. And the whole theme of it is, you know, the nuclear disaster and what it brought about. And the future implications for humanity. Plus, I mean, getting subtitled movies to show in major theaters, I think would have been a challenge for mainstream America, certainly at the time. I mean, it's something that still persists to this day, but to a lesser degree. But yeah, it's just when I'm watching the movie, even though I didn't have the full context for the original Godzilla, because I was watching, you know, the sort of the Americanized remake, there are certain things that just didn't make sense. Like when Raymond Burr is reporting from the scene of the destruction of Tokyo, and he's got all these vantage points he's watching, I'm like, where the hell are you watching this from? Are you like on a tower that's like on top of a hill, like the one mountain that Godzilla isn't destroying? Like, what is going on here? There's the scene in the original Godzilla where the people are debating what to do about the monster, and ends up in this full-blown like argument, people screaming at each other in this courtroom. We get that, but in King of the Monsters, but it's just like Raymond Burr in this sort of courtroom, and all of a sudden people start screaming at each other, and they're like, yeah, I guess this whatever happened over there is happening over there. We don't need to know about it because it's some weird Japanese thing, I guess. It doesn't work. And I think I am such a fan of Godzilla now, I finally get why people would love these movies. Now, I've only seen this one and the new Warner Brothers Legendary movies, and I think there's a wide gap there. But one of the things I think that I'm missing from these newer incarnations is what I got in the 54 Godzilla, which is a sincere story with something to say, I think really well-drawn characters. and, you know, surprises for something that's 70 years old. Whereas now I think a lot of these modern films have succumbed to the kind of the blockbuster syndrome where it's like, it's more about the spectacle. The other thing is, I don't know what happened, but I know it's a guy in a suit stomping through, you know, model cities and everything. But towards the end of the film, particularly the underwater climax and then that assault on Tokyo, there are tricks of the camera and just the immersion of the story. I forgot I was watching models and a guy in a suit. When Godzilla attacks the tower that has the news reporters in it, and they realize that they're all about to die, and they get that great perspective shot of them plummeting to their deaths into these, you know, rooftops. I felt like I was on a roller coaster. My stomach went up into my mouth. It's incredible.
Homage to that. There's a nice homage to that in Godzilla Minus One.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I want to see that. And, you know, unfortunately, from what I understand, they're still trying to work out the home video rights for that. It might be coming out in the fall, you know, practically a year after it wins the Oscar. And I'll put a brief plug in here, the Music Box Theater, which Bill just mentioned, in mid-June, they're having Godzilla versus the Music Box, where they're going to be showing the complete Showa era films and also Godzilla Minus One. So I'll have some information about that down below. Some people can check it out.
Shin Godzilla, the 200.
Oh, there you go.
2016 movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm okay. Not a fan of it, but that's for another discussion.
Well, Mark, I'm going to quit jawboning here. Tell me how you came to discover Godzilla, either the 54, the 56 version, or, you know, just Godzilla in general, and why are you a fan?
Well, my first introduction when I was a kid was Godzilla versus Megalon, because it was everywhere. And the reason it was everywhere is because someone screwed up on the distribution rights for, I believe, the VHS copy of it. They let the VHS version of it lapse into public domain, and so it was everywhere, but it was on cable for like all the time. So I ran across it there, and my dad was a big Godzilla fan, so I got to see the 56 version, because again, even in the early 80s with the home video craze, that was still the only one really on the shelves, was that one. It wasn't until years later I discovered, oh, there's an actual Japanese cut. And then I saw some of the other Showa era ones as well, because they were always on either on cable or independent channel 18 in Milwaukee, because that's where I'm from originally. They needed programming, so they would show some of these in an afternoon on a Saturday or on a Sunday. You would end up running across them because they were filling time when there wasn't sports to show. So, you know, I got them in pieces, not really in order. It wasn't until, years later but I loved it. I mean, it's big monsters, you know. For the longest time, it was just the monsters that was featured in a lot of those mid to late. And I'm sure Bill can definitely correct me. This is just my viewing experience. But a lot of those Showa era ones really were just mostly the monsters. I mean, the people were there, but it was more about the fighting of the creatures. Later on, especially, and then, you know,
think you're thinking more of the 70s films,
or it might be thinking of the 70s. Yeah, I'm thinking of the 70s,
the 60s,
right? Yeah, near the end, I should say, not middle, but yeah, near the end, when you and then you get into the weird Kazuki ones and all of those, but Godzuki, I mean, but yeah, I just, you know, I love big monsters, and those were the ones that I caught first, were a little bit more of the campier ones, and then I went back and I was a fan, because yeah, it big monsters fighting each other was amazing. And here, you know, they're fighting on miniature sets, and you know they're miniatures, but there wasn't stuff like that really coming out of U.S. viewing. you know, like that, for that scale, those big huge monsters like that, you weren't really getting those types of, you had King Kong, but you got those few and far between, whereas Japan was cranking these out. You know, there was a whole library of these Godzilla films, and so I get introduced to them. And then my buddy, who I met in middle school, who one of them that I'm still friends with today, he's a huge Godzilla fan, and he actually hooked me up with the Toho version. That's my version. Not a Blu-ray, but it's the DVD version that's got on two different discs. It's got the Japanese version on one disc and the US one on the other. The US one is the 4:3 aspect ratio, and the Japanese one is from the 35 millimeter print. So he caught me that, but yeah, I just fell in love with big monster films with those type of colorful monster battle ones from, as Bill mentioned, more like the 70s and that, cause those were the ones that were showing when I was a kid. A few years ago, before Godzilla King of the Monsters, the legendary movie came out, I noticed how many there were out at the time and how many days in the month were until leading up to Godzilla. So I did a full month to where I watched all the Godzilla films, because it was 31 Godzilla films, I think it was, out at the time. And including the Netflix animated ones. So I watched one a day and reviewed it one a day. And leading up to Godzilla King Kong. And when doing that, I did some research. It's amazing how many American and Japanese versions of these films there are. It's not just the original and King Kong versus Godzilla, which we're going to be talking about on my show end of the month. There's other versions as well, including Godzilla 1985. There were two different versions. Godzilla 2000, there's two different versions, because one has the bad dubbing, which my friends and I went to see in the movie theater when Godzilla 2000 came out, and we laughed our asses off as you have one of the dubbed lines go, "Great Caesar's ghost!" And the other great line from that one for the dubbing, this was the dubbing, not subtitle, it was like, "This missile will go through Godzilla like crap through a goose." So, you know, I mean, but my mind was blown how many of these, especially from the 50s, in early 60s, there were two different versions of these films released. And some of them are quite different than the others as far as tone goes, you know, and other ones, not quite so much, more just slight changes. But it was crazy. So that's my long and short of it.
Two things before I forget. Mm. And we're also going to get some comments, because we got a bunch rolling in. 1998, Matthew Broderick starred in Godzilla, one of the most overhyped and poorly received films in blockbuster history. Bill, you're biting the fist is the exact right reaction. I remember going to see that with my friend Brian in the theater, and within the first minute of this, I think it was 2 hours or over 2 hours mm-hmm. long,
it's over
I knew, yeah, I knew that I wanted to leave, but I was trapped there. I think, and honestly, and this, I talk about this more than in the hypothetical, but I actually had, I think I blocked it out, but I have a real world example of why these new remakes, these extended franchises, these zombie franchises can actually do harm to the legacy films that they're trying to capitalize on. Because I think that was actually my first real experience with Godzilla, because I'd heard a lot about it and everyone was hyping up, oh, it's a new Godzilla movie. I'm like, okay, let's see what this is all about. And I went to see it. I'm like, this is really dumb and really boring. And I don't care if there's, you know, four decades or whatever it was that preceded this. Great. So there's four decades of this, not interested. And I think that's one of the things that kind of, you know, kept me away from these things, except for, you know, I watched the legendary ones for what, I can't remember why I watched those. Was it for, I don't know if it was for your show, Mark, but or something else.
I think it was at the time you were reviewing more things at the time. More wide release. You were reviewing more wide release things at the time. What's funny is that Broderick one is part, Toho does consider it in its library of monsters, but it's not referred to as Godzilla. He's referred to as Zilla. Mm-hmm. And he showed up in one of the later Godzilla films, Godzilla SOS, I think.
Final Wars.
Final Wars, thank you. Godzilla Final Wars. And it is the best battle, because it lasts all of 10 seconds, and it's Toho really sticking its finger up at this monster, because they have it poorly CGI'd. It comes after Godzilla. Godzilla literally grabs him, throws him into the Australian Opera House, and proceeds to atomic fire him completely, and the whole fight takes less than 30 seconds.
I watched that. Most of the fights in that movie are about 30.
That's true. That's true, though. You're right. But it's funny how they treated that one.
Well, I mean, rightfully so, because wow. The other thing I wanted to point out, and one of the reasons that I just couldn't jive with the Raymond Burr version, is I was with it for a while because yes, Steve Martin, intrepid reporter, who gets kind of distracted on his international trip. He sets down in Japan to go meet with a scientist friend or something. And all of a sudden, there's this giant monster on the rampage, and he sticks around to cover it. Fine. It's his kind of travelogue. He's narrating the whole thing. It starts off with him emerging from the wreckage of, you know, Tokyo and flashing back, you know, a week ago, things were very different. And that's fine, except that he starts talking about these characters, you know, Ogata, Emiko, Shirozawa, these acquaintances he comes to know who are in like this love triangle, and one's a military guy, the other's a scientist, and there's the girl caught in between. And referring to situations that he finds himself in, like he just happens to be wherever they are. But halfway through the movie, I think it's because they ran out of ways to insert Raymond Burr into it. They just start following this trio of characters, and the movie shifts to intimate scenes between these three that Raymond Burr would have no knowledge of and has no connection to, and all of a sudden the narration drops out. So it's completely sloppy. I understand they were doing the best that they could with what they had, but then you go and watch the source material and you're like, oh, that's why none of this made any sense. There is a beautiful scene that completely underscores Shirozawa's sacrifice at the end. And I'm not going to put the spoiler banner, folks, because it's 70 years old. Most of you have probably seen Godzilla. Most of you are probably yelling at your screen right now saying two things. A, Ian, read the comments already. And B, how is it that you've never seen Godzilla before now? Well, I haven't, but I rectified that situation the other day. But Shirozawa is talking about how he's created this oxygen, just like little capsule with the moving parts. It basically sucks, or it converts all matter that it comes in into contact with, or all the oxygen, into liquid or something. It basically disintegrates all underwater life in the vicinity. And he doesn't want to, he discovered it by accident, and he's terrified of what he's made. It's a great metaphor for the atomic age, I think. He decides that he doesn't want to use it, even to stop Godzilla, until Godzilla destroys Tokyo, and he's convinced, well, there's only one way to do it, but he also doesn't want this weapon to get out to the wider world. And Ogata and Emiko say, well, you can just destroy it. And he's like, well, yeah, I can burn all my paperwork and destroy all my research, but bad people can get a hold of me and torture me for the information I have in my head. And at the end of the film, Ogata is on the ship and he goes down to take the oxygen destroyer, and Shirozawa decides, I'm going to go with you. And at the end, much like another great movie from 1998, Armageddon, he decides to stay behind to see the mission through and save the world. Mm-hmm. And it was that speech about not letting the people who would torture him to get the information to reconstruct the bomb that really drives home like his sacrifice at the end. Like, why is he doing this? It's a really dark moment, but it's also kind of tender. And what do we get in the Raymond Burr version? Nothing. That entire speech is gone. You get him for out of like no context, he goes, ah, and then all of a sudden he decides to go burn his paperwork, and there's no mention of torture or any of that nonsense. So more strikes against Mr. Raymond Burr's version. Okay, we're gonna start from the top here. Indulge me, dear panelists and audience, as we go through the comments. Mr. David Wilt joining us once again. One of the Transformers movies that probably no one ever talks about is the 80s anime. What do you mean no one ever talks about? This is the only one I ever talk about.
We talk about that one quite a bit.
David Wilt, the song The Touch by Stan Bush is a very iconic 80s song. Yes, and I got to meet Stan Bush. Probably my top three celebrity encounters ever. I met him at Comic-Con by chance. And I have a signed photo of him with his awesome guitar and his even more awesome 80s hair. And he asked me, hey, I got a new album out. Would you like to buy that for $10? I said, no, thanks, but it was great meeting you. Renee Cruz, lots of emojis, and Godzilla X Kong, the new empire. Okay. David Wilt says again, I think that what makes the original Godzilla such an iconic movie is it came out during the time when America had feared the atomic bomb. I think there's a lot to that, but I think that's one of the disappointments that I had with Godzilla 56 is I feel like they still could have gotten a lot of that. And I'm looking at this through a 2024 lens, but I'm thinking there's so much great social commentary that's woven into the science fiction story of the original Godzilla that they could have easily poured that over with voiceover or other characters, you know, standing in for, you know, with Raymond Burr. I don't know. It just seemed like the popcorn version of a really serious sci-fi film. And again, I understand its importance, but, you know.
One of the big things that I noticed when I finally saw the original version was a scene on a train with commuters. They're talking about, you know, it's almost like lighthearted, like, oh, evacuate again. And, you know, I had to go through Nagasaki. I don't want to have to do with that. And then in that, not in that meeting where Dr. Yamani shows the slides and starts talking about the fact that Godzilla is radioactive, there's a pretty obvious indication that they want to cover this up because they don't want a certain country to get upset with them. And obviously that country is the United States. And I found both of those things to be really, really strong and like meaningful. And, you know, it's like, well, this isn't just a giant monster movie.
Mm-hmm. Right. And those stuck out to me, too. And that scene that you just mentioned about the cover up, that was what led to the big kind of argument, that kerfuffle, mm-hmm. because there are the two kind of factions like, I don't care if certain people get mad at us, we have to stop this thing. You know, we need to get the word out.
One of the subtitles has there's a woman who's saying that we have to let this stuff out. And on one of the versions of the subtitle, the things I've seen, the other politician says, pipe down, you crackpot.
Nice.
I don't think that's on all of them.
No, that's not on all of them, no.
The one that I saw was most amusing.
I got to get that one. You know, that would be the next Criterion version, is to collect all the weird subtitled versions and put those as alternate subtitle options.
Well, the Criterion one has different subtitles than that one that you have, Mark. That
this
was
one?
The first. Yeah, I think my friend Ed did the commentary on that one.
Really?
Oh, so, cool. Yeah.
Ed
Gazaszewski.
Gazaszewski.
His real name, by the way.
Oh, I believe it.
He is the, you know, you probably should have gotten him on here because he could go in depth on this like way more than me. He and his friend Steve Reifel wrote a book called, I've got it right here, a biography of Ishiro Honda.
Oh, nice.
It tells a lot. It's actually really good. Got a foreword by Martin Scorsese. A very small foreword. But if you get a chance to listen to that commentary, I really recommend it. They get really into depth with it. And, you know, unlike a lot of commentaries where like, yeah, that was a really hot day we were filming that. Yeah, it was hot, all right. All right, I'll get off the soapbox for a while.
All right, so let's see. David Wilt, again, I think that what makes these giant monsters so iconic is during the first half of the movie, we don't see the monster in its full form. Mm-hmm. That's true. You know, Spielberg, I think, kind of aped this a few years later with Jaws. And it's interesting because I actually watched the first maybe 15, 20 minutes of Godzilla 56 with my son, because on YouTube, there's a very strange series. I don't even know what they're called, but they're these crudely animated kaiju monster matches where you've got Godzilla fighting all assortment of different creatures. Some, you know, other legit kaiju, some internet meme monsters like Skibbity Toilet, which if you don't know what that is, don't look it up. But he became obsessed with Godzilla. He drew a picture of Godzilla that I've got hanging up in the hall. It's very cute. So I said, hey, you want to watch the original Godzilla? He said, I don't like black and white movies. And then after I picked him up off the floor, just kidding. No, I said, no, it'll be fun. You know, you've never seen a black and white movie before. It's cool. It's, you know, it's not lame like you might think it is. I mean, he's six. But so we watched it and he was kind of into it, but then he said, Dad, can we turn this off? And I realized it's because we hadn't seen Godzilla and it was like 20 minutes in. This is the Raymond Burr version. There's so much talking and exposition and meetings and stuff. Like the most we see, I think, is the initial attack on the village on Odo Island, where it's at night and you just see Godzilla's leg like in the corner of the screen behind a house. And then you've got that great shot of it looked like someone left their toy helicopter on the beach and it just kind of like tips over. It's the one miniature effect that I thought was kind of dodgy in the whole thing. But, you know, what do I know? So we fast forwarded to part of the attack on Tokyo. And I was like, isn't this cool? And he's like, yeah. And like, you want to finish watching this later? No. So yeah, we got some learning to do, but watching the Honda version from 54, it feels like it moves a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. It takes probably half the time to get into the business of what is this monster. Let's see. The original Godzilla came out the same year Raymond Burr starred in the iconic Hitchcock classic Rear Window. Was that really 54? 54. Wow, man. Yeah, that was a creepy performance.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most popular series to use Japanese footage was the series Power Rangers. That series was American version of the Japanese called Super Sentai, not to be confused with Super Hentai, which is something else entirely.
Entirely, yes.
Yes. I think Godzilla was inspired by the 1953 movie. Oh, Bill.
Godzilla. I think Godzilla stepped by his place there and knocked his background over.
Oh man, we should do like the vibration. Oh, he's attacking the live stream. But I think
I would have loved it if I could have had arranged like five naked women to go screaming.
There you go.
Yeah, but Bill, you're not
doing that often here.
Well, also you're not recording from your basement tonight. I think Godzilla was inspired by the 53 movie The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, and both movies include a scene where a monster attacks a lighthouse.
Lighthouse and Godzilla? Well, okay, yes. Definitely inspired by. In fact, Ray Harryhausen, who animated The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, hated Godzilla because he just felt it was a ripoff. And I think, maybe a little ironically, I think that Godzilla actually was a better movie than Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. I mean, in Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, the monster was killed by a radioactive bullet or capsule. So that sort of different approach of radiation is your friend to you're all going to die, I think is a pretty big thing. But yeah, I think even one of the original titles for the film had something like the giant monster from 20,000 leagues or, you know. So yeah, it is definitely, I wouldn't call it a ripoff, but I would call it inspired by. And originally it wasn't even going to be, it came about because a deal that fell through with a movie that was to be made in Indonesia, and the producer Tomoyuki Tanaka was flying back and desperately trying to find something that he could use. And he said something about like being on the plane, looking down at the ocean, and then like wondering, well, what would it be like if something came up out of there? And so there we are. Anyway, wow. I don't remember Godzilla attacking a lighthouse in the first film. I mean,
I don't either.
But
I don't know if there was an attack, but wasn't there? There was a concern about like not having the beacons, the spotlights, the big spotlights, because that would attack or draw his attention. But I don't know if that was a lighthouse. Mm-hmm. I did pick up, and I think this might have been a difference between the 54 and the 56 version, because in the 54 version, they definitely made a big deal about, you know, not using those spotlights. And then when he goes to attack the reporters, there's that clear shot of their like flash bulbs and cameras and stuff going off, and that really drew his attention. I didn't pick up on that in the Steve Martin cut, so I don't even know if that line was in there, but it's great because not only is there, it's a real moment of horror when you realize, oh yeah, they just made that spotlight comment like 5 minutes ago, and now we're seeing the camera flashes go off, so those guys are screwed. But also just the resignation of those reporters. There's the one guy who's like yelling into the microphone, like, Godzilla's coming. I think this might be the end. I'm signing off, folks. He's like gone insane. He's not scared. He's not panicking. No one's trying to escape.
Sweat. Mm-hmm. And it looks like the guy really is terrified.
And contrast that with Raymond Burr, who once again is like watching from some vantage point, like, oh my God, I can't believe what I'm seeing. Ugh. All right, let's see. On the series Rugrats, the character Reptar was inspired by Godzilla. All right. Yep. In the 70s, there was a Godzilla animated series.
Yep. I actually got about 6 episodes on DVD.
Was that released. Like an American series or like a Japanese series?
Yeah, okay. Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a Hanna-Barbera, so you can know what the animation's like, too. So, yeah, it's
Fred Flintstone show up and fight Godzilla.
No, but it's interesting. It's really, yeah.
Even I haven't watched that, so.
Yeah, it's not an easy watch. Maybe when you're very young, sure, but watching it now, it hurts.
Let's see. Oh, yes. Okay. David, yes. Thank you for reminding me of the actual first Godzilla movie I ever watched. When I was 11, I saw the animated short Godzilla versus Bambi. He's reminding me of that now.
They played that before the Godzilla 1985. Mm-hmm. Because I remember the big media blitz, because there was even a news report, because they had a guy in a suit show up at like the New York premiere or something, and they were showing footage of it. And so I went to see it in the theater, and beforehand there was this line drawing animation, and I'm like, what's this? And it said Godzilla versus Bambi, and I'm like, okay. And they show it, you know, it's so short, but they actually put that in front of Godzilla 1985. Yeah. And I saw that in the theater. We just laughed. It was hilarious.
That used to be a staple of, like, well, they used to have these animation festivals where they would show animated shorts for, you know, 2 hours or something every year. And, yeah, that one would show up all the time. Directed by a guy named Marv Newland, who later became kind of a celebrity in the short animation character crowd.
Well, I just remember the gimmick of that was you had this deer like eating grass, and the credits going by Godzilla versus Bambi, like written by Marv Newland. Yeah. Okay. And then like all the credits were him, like edited and all this stuff. And at the very end, boom, Godzilla's foot just comes down and mashes Bambi. I first saw that, I think I was 11. I got a VHS tape of, like, I think it was called like Weird Cartoons or Crazy Cartoons. And they had all bunch of these shorts. And one of them wasn't even a cartoon. It was, I don't know when it was, from the 40s maybe, but it was a live action mixed with kind of like stop motion animation. I think it's a pretty famous short of a guy working in a factory, and this little bird hatches out a car, and this car hatches from an egg and like kind of like unfolds, and I still don't know how the hell they did it, because it is very smooth, but I'll have to find that someday. Anyway, yeah, Godzilla versus Bambi. I love this. I'm dredging up all these movies. Godzilla has been with me my entire life. I just didn't know he was there. All right, so
One of the things that you notice watching them back to back, and it's what I noticed when I did my monthly Godzilla film, but especially watching the 56 and 54, if you watch them just back to back like that, is the 56 version tries a little bit to play the angle of the evil of radiation and nukes, kind of. There is tossed in there about, you know, how Godzilla got woke up. But you're just missing a lot more of the human element that the 54 has, because the 54 has literally a scene where, if I remember correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but there's one scene where Godzilla's walking up, and I think it's a mom or a parent or something, and a kid, and they're by a building, and they see Godzilla walking up, and there's no music. It just, you see Godzilla walking up to it, and they just look terrified. And you get other moments like that, to where, you know, in the beginning, they really breeze by the whole setup that the 54 version does. In the 56 version, they breeze by it, of the shipping lanes getting ruined and how there's no fish in the sea for these folks to catch so they could actually live, because these villages are rely on the fish. You know, I mean, there's so much of that human element missing in the 56 version, because they got Raymond Burr to pull an Orson Welles of Transformers, to where they gave him a script and said, okay, stand here, you're going to see a creature of some sort. And he's like, okay, and now read this line. But I don't even know if he saw footage of Godzilla beforehand. And for, you know, for being a global reporter, did he have to remind us so many times that his Japanese was rusty, or it was rough, or he couldn't quite understand Japanese? What are they saying? And they got the most Americanized Japanese actors to act around him, because we're talking 56 here. So you're just like, it's like totally different tone between these two films.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the mother and her, I think it was one or two kids, but
two.
Her, in the hospital, and the mom is dead, and the kids start crying. I don't know how the kids survived, because it seemed like a building was dropped on them. The mom has dialogue about how, you know, it's okay. You're going to see your father soon.
Yes.
Which is, you know, that's
right. It's really dark and surprising. And I think it's right around that time you see some people who are like kind of on this balcony, and then Godzilla swipes it or steps on it, something, and the whole thing comes crashing down. I mean, you don't need a lot of inserts of people like actually dying or gore or anything. Like, I think seeing it from that remove just really sells the casualness of Godzilla walking through these villages. And I think that's, or these cities, and it's intellectually, I put something together in my head. I'm like, yeah, these are all models, or a lot of it, you know, are models. And that's kind of fine, because I think that goes along with the idea of, you know, to us who are, you know, Godzilla's 400 feet tall, we would be just like batting around playthings and stomping through cardboard. You know, he wouldn't even really notice until he gets electrocuted. And my goodness, the special effects in Godzilla, I'll just refer to the Godzilla 54, because the 56 version, it had a lot of that stuff in there. But like you were saying, Mark, a lot of the detail, a lot of the kind of the setup to the big action set pieces really is missing. It's noticeable. But like when he charges up, like the giant spikes on the back of his body, I've seen the legendary versions. I've seen the trailers for the new Godzilla movies. And I'm sorry, I keep harping on them. No, I'm not sorry.
No, you're not. But don't lie.
You see them charge up, and now they're pink, I guess, and before they were blue and everything. But it's not impressive, because I know how that stuff is done now. In Godzilla 54, I'm looking at this 70-year-old cinema technology, and I don't know how they do it. I mean, I'm sure there's probably some simple explanation, and I don't want either of you to break the magic for me here on this live stream, but it's just so impressive watching this special effect. Like, I believe what I'm seeing, whereas the problem with the modern films, like a lot of CGI blockbusters now, is I do believe what I'm seeing, but I just don't care, because there's no mystery as to how it was done.
I've always liked the fins, dorsal fins lighting up, like generally before you shoot. It's like this weird thing that's like, well, where did they come up with that? Because, you know, you wouldn't, you know, you'd have a dragon or something, but you would never have like other parts of its body light up before it shoots flame. And I like that anticipation. And that, I mean, that's always been one of the more unique things about this monster in general, is that you have this sort of ramping up thing, and it's not done like super dramatic or anything. It's just like, oh, this is happening now. And then, you know, that's when you first see that he has some kind of the atomic ray, is that as when he melts the high tension towers, which, by the way, were made out of wax.
That explains how that,
by big huge studio lights, which I thought was, it's a brilliant idea. Mm-hmm. They really you know, the effects director Eiji Tsuburaya said that something in the nature of like, our effects are born out of our poverty. Mm-hmm. And we've had to would like just come up with like whatever we can do to make something work, because they just didn't have the resources. Even though at that time Godzilla was tied with Seven Samurai for being the most expensive film that Toho had produced until that time.
Well, I mean, you talk about the melting power lines. I mean, that's another. You tell me it's wax being melted by studio lights. That's a great how. But when I'm watching that scene and I see, you know, they look like white hot metal that's bending and melting under the power of this atomic ray. But I also want to comment on, I knew that Godzilla breathed fire, but I don't, and I'm not sure if this is in the other movies or if they actually use a fire breathing kind of effect like they do in the legendary movies. Now it's all like a CGI beam that comes out of his mouth. But what fascinated me was you'd get a close-up of Godzilla's head and neck and you kind of go, and there was like a mist almost blowing out of his mouth, or like a spray. It wasn't fire, but then you'd cut to whatever he had blown that onto, and then it kind of catches on fire. It's very interesting. It's almost spookier than actually seeing the flames come out of his mouth. It's like almost whatever he breathed out exploded on contact with the surface of whatever it hit.
I'm not sure how they did that effect. I think it might have been as simple as having a spray can inside of the puppet head.
It kind of looks like that, but I think it's a combination of the music and the roar and that it does sound like a spray can, but it's just it's spooky and unexpected. Let's see. Oh, hold on. David's back. In the scene where the scientist first shows his girlfriend his oxygen destroyer, we don't see it, but we can tell by the expression on her face that she sees something horrible. Yeah, that was a great moment, because I actually rewound. I cheated. I rewound because I'm like, wait, did we see what she saw? No, we see that later. It was a great moment of a flashback. And I just want to talk about that story, that love triangle between Ogata and Emiko and Shirozawa. You know, she was engaged to be married to Shirozawa, but she was in love with Ogata, really. Mm-hmm. And there was that whole like angle of Ogata's working for the government, and Emiko
actually Ogata works for a shipping company.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a shipping. Okay. That's why he was on the boats and stuff. I thought he was hanging out with the military a lot, probably because of the shipping, the boat connection. But the point is, Emiko gets this secret that Shirozawa shares with her about the oxygen destroyer. And he's like, you can never tell anybody about this. And of course she tells her boyfriend and her father, the great Dr. Yamane. He is the one who's championing, let's study Godzilla, let's try and not necessarily capture it, because I don't think we can, but we shouldn't just kill it, because it's the greatest scientific discovery ever. And it isn't until later in the movie where everyone kind of realizes, well, we might not have a choice. Mm-hmm. Because this thing unleashed could wipe out everybody if it escapes Japan. But yeah, these great kind of moral dilemmas and quandaries are all over the film. And when we see this oxygen destroyer, we see the look on Emiko's face, and she screams, and she practically passes out. And then later we get to see what actually happens to that tank in a flashback. And it's horrifying. We see these beautiful fish swimming around, and then all of a sudden, through the magic of editing and smoke in an aquarium, I guess, we see them turn into bones. And that's something that I really want to get into your theories about this. In the 1956 version, there's no talk about, because they cut out Dr. Yamane's speech about, there's other radiation out there, there could be more Godzillas. In that version, it's pretty definitive. Godzilla, we see him turn into bones, and then those bones turn into nothing, to pure water. So at the end of the 56 version, there's like, well, how the hell are they going to make a Godzilla sequel? Whereas the end of the first Godzilla, it's implied that, yes, this Godzilla turned to dust, but much like Jaws the Revenge from 1987, there could be relatives out there somewhere.
Well, it's a little funny because in 1955, they made the sequel.
Yeah.
Which is, pre the Raymond Burr version. The Raymond Burr version, by the way, got released in Japan, and they cropped it into CinemaScope. Yeah, it's a little weird. I've got a poster for it, and I don't think I actually haven't watched it, but it's just one of those weird things that you don't have an easy explanation for. I was going to say one of the things that I really like about Dr. Yamani's character, played by Takeshi Shimura, who's a great, great actor. He's the leader of the Seven Samurai. There's a film called Ikiru, which is called To Live, and he plays a guy dying of stomach cancer that just, you know, if you don't start crying at the end of that movie, then, you know, anyway, he's not like just one of these scientists that would say like, oh, we got to keep him alive and just to study him. He's like, well, we need to study him because he survived the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
We need to see and if he can survive the bomb, maybe there's a way that human beings could. And I thought that was a really nice touch that, you know, it isn't just some kind of pure, you know, scientist who's going to, you know, I don't know if you've seen the Howard Hawks version of The Thing, but the scientist there who basically, you know, flips out and, you know, the thing is, he's killing everybody, but, you know, he stands in the way and, you know, whatever. But Yamani actually has more depth than that. But, yeah, then once Tokyo is destroyed, it's...
yeah.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, there wasn't... I don't think that was a... Thank you for reminding me, Bill, because that was a layer of his character that I had forgotten about. But there wasn't the modern conception of the nefarious scientist that mm-hmm. we get where it's like, oh, we should keep him alive, like something from Weyland Yutani. Like we got to keep it alive so we can study it and use it as a weapon, you know, perhaps to get back at the United States or those other countries that were kind of mentioned. Was that ever a conception in any of the other like sequels, like figuring out the secrets of Godzilla to weaponize it, or was it all about just like staving off these monsters?
Mm-mm.
No.
No, I mean, you get aliens later on involved that kind of use the monsters of Earth. But humans themselves, I think the only weaponization you could say is when you get to the Mecha Godzilla, but that's not involving Godzilla itself. It's creating a weapon to fight or defend themselves against Godzilla based off of Godzilla. You get Mecha Godzilla, but I can't think of any where it's humans weaponizing him.
No,
well,
nothing.
Yeah.
In all the 70 years of Godzilla movies, they've never come up with that idea of like, let's turn Godzilla into a weapon to like fight our enemies.
The aliens do that to try to take over the Earth a few times, right. But no, there's...
not people. No countries ever try to take him over.
Those monsters are treated more like as just, I don't know, forces of nature, hurricanes, that kind of thing. You know,
but even the United States has like experimented with energy weapons. Now, look, I'm just saying... Like make a sequel like they did with Godzilla Minus One, make a sequel to one of these aliens attack and try and use Godzilla against us movies and say, I'm glad we survived that. But those aliens had the right idea. What if we could harness the power? I'm surprised. Guys, okay, I'm going to turn off this live stream. We're going to go write this script together and make tens of dollars.
In Destroy All Monsters, the 10 monsters that are taken over by the aliens, the Earth people do crack the code, as it were. And are able to control to attack the aliens. Of course, at that point, the aliens send King Ghidorah in to have the big battle of lots of giant monsters.
Yes. I love Destroy All Monsters. That one's so it's a lot of fun. It is a lot of
I'm gonna have to check it out. As I mentioned. Like I finally get the Godzilla thing now. You guys, I've always appreciated your love for these movies. I just never really got it. I think because I spent my time watching all the wrong ones. But you know, Godzilla 54, the Raymond Burr one is a fascination. I would even recommend that if you've never seen Godzilla somehow, that you watch both those movies back to back. I think it's a great kind of like not even just for what they did with this movie, but just think of the possibilities of other ways you could do that with different films, just like intercut someone, you know, being an observer somewhere. I mean, you could do that with anything. You could do that with Alien. I don't know. I'm rambling at this point. Yeah.
With the Raymond Burr thing, I know that it's inferior. I don't think they did that terrible of a job with it. I mean, at least looking, you know, like from my point of view, it is a little bit, I hesitate to use the word racist, but it is a little like, well, we can't accept a movie with a bunch of Japanese people running around in it.
Well, I mean, especially because you're talking about, you know, this was just a decade removed from like Pearl Harbor. So yeah. And internment camps and like, it wasn't exactly like, hey, there's a great Japanese sentiment running through the red, white, and blue. So yeah, I can understand. I thought about that at the time. Yeah, too.
Think about, you know, you've already done like some of these movies, the Quatermass movies with Brian Dunlavy, where it was like, well, a supremely British character replaced by an American, a Curse of the Demon. Mm-hmm. You have Dana Andrews as the star, as American, everybody else is British. And so, I mean, and those are all 50s movies. And I don't know, I mean, maybe it is just this kind of thought at that time. It's like, well, we can't just have a bunch of foreigners running around, even if they speak English.
They're products of their time, for sure. I mean, you know, we did a series called It Came from the 50s, where we were looking at, you know, 50s monster films, one each month. And it was very interesting to see the wide spectrum of how they approached the creatures or the aliens or where they come from, as well as their approach to, you know, foreign immigrants and such as well. And you're right. They couldn't probably in 50s, they're sitting here going, this is a cool monster film, but there's no way we're going to be able to market it to our Western audience if we don't have. And then they cast one of the most probably American of American guys to play, you know, and then they got some Asian actors, but then the Asian actors speak, you know, perfect English, you know, for the most part. And so, yeah, it was to get people to the box office.
Yeah.
I mean, right. Yeah, they had slight accents, some of them, but some of them, you know, spoke very clear. And it's just a product of its time, because Hollywood is all about money. And they're like, that's the only way they figured they're going to market it to this audience. Some of them, many of them war veterans. You know, you're not going to want a Japanese led film if you're going to want it to be successful at the box office.
And that came out during the time that these monster movies were at a bit of a peak. It's to me, it's kind of amazing that the American movies, the 50s B movies starting from like Them and going through, you know, Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, everything else, that kind of stuff petered out in the United States in the early 60s. But in Japan, they just kept making these things, not just Godzilla movies, but they had their own King Kong movies. They had different alien invasion movies.
Mysterians was great. I love Mysterians.
Yeah, I can spend a whole year talking about that film. The theme. But you don't want to hear that.
Well, not yet. But no, I mean, I do want to say about the Raymond Burr version, some of the, you know, it's not a controversy, but I mean, just like the idea of, you know, the Americanization of this Japanese film. You know, one thing I will say is that it is, I think, very respectful in its handling of these characters, right? Even though a lot of them are inserted because you've got to get this, you know, American actor into this situation. So like, okay, he was on his way somewhere else and he stopped over in Japan. He's got this friend and he's talking to all these different people. These different situations, he's treating them all as peers and friends. And he very much is in a lot of ways a fish out of water. And so he's not busting in there with his big American bravado and, you know, I'm going to straighten this whole thing out and save the world. You know, he's in many, he's a competent professional But he's not a cartoon, you know, G.I. Joe American hero guy. So that was nice to see. It's just that while I was watching him in this movie, I could very clearly see the cuts of like, okay, so this is the part, like him and his friend were like sleeping outside in this tent on Odo Island. And I could tell that the stuff that was going on inside the house, that was from the real movie. And this whole thing with the tent, my wife had like popped in to watch a couple minutes of it. I was like, what, why are they like, it's outside there. There's like a typhoon going on. They're still like lying there. Why don't they go for cover or something? Yeah. What are they doing? And that was my whole question. The opening of this film where Steve Martin is in the rubble. I felt like that went on for 5 minutes. I mean, he's just like, it's just voiceover of him. Like, what's going on? What it took forever. And I think that's one of the reasons that my son checked out. Whereas, Honda knew how to get down to business. That's all I'm saying.
And don't forget about the stand-in bodies for the American version, the stand-in folks who were shot all from behind.
Yep. Oh, yeah. When he met Emiko and she's like,
One thing that is interesting though, is that, you know, he was stuck in there to get like an American name on the poster, whatever.
Yeah.
But later on in the 60s, they started having American actors in there. Nick Adams was in two films. Russ Tamblyn was in War of the Gargantuas. Cesar Romero and Joseph Cotten were in Latitude Zero in like 1970. Very strange film. Rhodes Reason was in King Kong Escapes. So they eventually, like, went, as these films became more popular, not just in Japan, but also overseas, the people in Toho started making deals and, you know, getting some Americans. And those would generally be the lead characters in these movies.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what you're seeing now with the legendary films. I mean, with the King Kong and the Godzilla and the whole like monsterverse thing, you've got like Sam Jackson, John C. Reilly, Dan Stevens, you know, a lot of, you know, bigger names in these, you know, kind of, I guess, modern day homages to the classic movies. I feel like I'm going to throw up even just saying that. But okay. I want to end on a positive note. I loved Godzilla. I loved talking to you guys about it. I know we were kind of pinballing all over the place, but it was a fascinating kind of experiment to watch these movies, you know, almost back to back. I think only separated by one or two evenings. If you've never seen Godzilla, I highly recommend it. You know, definitely pick up the Criterion Blu-ray or go see it like at a revival house. I mean, it's the 70th anniversary, so it's, chances are it's gonna be playing somewhere at a theater, like an art house theater near you if you have one. Like at the Music Box in Chicago in June. Information down below. Definitely go check that out. I do want to see this on the big screen, so I'm going to have to swing by the Music Box, because even watching it on television, I know I said I was going to wrap it up, but I do have to go on one more jag. I hadn't seen any other Ishiro Honda movies. Bill or Mark, I assume you have? I just don't know. Is this indicative of his style of filmmaking?
Yes and no. The next film that he directed, the next Godzilla film that he directed was King Kong versus Godzilla, which is a comedy. I mean, it's an intentional comedy, making fun of commercialization. And the other films then are they're sort of more straightforward. They're not like they're not nearly as heavy or dark. They're fun films. Mm-hmm. Well done. I think they've got like a lot of good from the sort of Toho actors collection. He uses a lot of them. Like the actor who played Ogata, Akira Takarada, is in a lot of the other films.
Yeah.
And so is Dr. Yamane and Dr. Sarazawa. You just see these guys. Sometimes they only have like a little walk-on role. But yeah, that's the guy. And if you've seen these films enough times, you start recognizing all these little weird players and things that are sort of the Toho regulars.
Yeah, the guy who played Sirizawa, was it the oxygen?
Yeah, Akihiko Harada. Yeah,
he was in a lot of them. When I was doing that 31 Days of Godzilla, I was like, oh wait, he's in this again. Only this time he's playing a different character.
Yeah.
And then, oh yeah,
eye patch on the other eye.
Actually, yeah.
Right. Yeah, and Ebira. He's the commandant of the red bamboo.
Ebira. I've not seen it, but that is my favorite Beatles album. I just gotta say, come on, Bill, you gotta do the effect.
What effect?
The sound, you know.
No, I'm not gonna do that. I can't. I can't pull.
I can't do it on command.
Create the sound of a rosin glove on a contrabass.
I didn't know that was what that was. Anyway, it'll be a mystery, much like the International Judas. But no, my question about Ishiro Honda was watching this movie on my quote unquote big screen TV. Yes, it's only 43 inches. That's what she said. I was like, I feel like I'm watching this on a big screen. I don't know what it was, but I definitely, there's just such a cinematic art to the 54, not so much the 56 Godzilla that, I was completely swept up in it and lost in this world. I can only imagine seeing it on a giant screen.
He has a very sort of documentary style. I mean, he'd made a number of other movies that were World War II based. And then he made like Salaryman, slice of life movies. There's one theme that sort of runs through a lot of his science fiction movies is this sort of how human beings have to kind of forget about borders and work together. In The Mysterians, which is called Earth Defense Force, the theme is, yeah, we got to stop like bickering, and we've got this other enemy to deal with. In Gorath, there's a very dense planet that is running towards Earth, and everybody has to get together and build giant jets in Antarctica to move the Earth out of the way. Which
wow.
Is the subject of a movie called The Wandering Earth. But The Wandering Earth does not have a giant walrus in it, so it is inferior.
Did you guys ever see that episode of the new Twilight Zone called A Small Talent for War?
Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
You can probably find it on YouTube. It's one of those, like, the shorter segments. John Glover plays an alien who shows up at the UN and says, our planet is part of a giant federation of intergalactic, we're a consortium. We've noticed that your planet has a small talent for war, and you guys better get your act together or we're going to come back and blow you up. And so 2 days later, he shows back up at the UN and the entire planet has come together. They've signed all these peace treaties. They've completely disarmed. They've destroyed all their weapons. And the one representative hands John Glover's character a huge book and says, here, it's all signed, sealed, and delivered. See for yourself. The guy starts flipping through it and he starts laughing. He's like, there is a huge misunderstanding. We are a garrulous species, and your planet is just too pathetic in terms of its, you're not warlike enough. So we have no use for you. So now we're going to blow you up. And then the ships close in on the planet. Everything goes dark. Very funny.
It's and twist book.
Mm-hmm. It is a cookbook. That's there should have been a recipe that fell out of it, but he wasn't a Canimate. He kind of looked like one though, big shoulders. Anyway, I'm going to let everybody go now. Thank you, Bill and Mark. All your information is going to be down below, maybe now, or if not now, then by tomorrow, along with the information for the Godzilla versus the Music Box and whatever else I can think to throw in. It's been a lot of fun catching up on Godzilla with you guys. And folks out there, thank you for hanging out. David Wilt and who else? I forgot. I got to go up and get this Another comment. Renee Cruz, the big fan of Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire. Thank you for commenting. And if you're watching this on the replay, yeah, thank you. Let us know, what is your favorite Godzilla movie, your favorite kaiju movie? What did you think of Godzilla 54? What did you think of Godzilla versus Steve Martin, which is what I think Godzilla 56 should officially be called. Yeah, and if you like this live stream, please like, subscribe, all that business. And Bill, you're waving your hand. You want to either get off here or you want to say something.
I'm surprised that you did not ask Mark and I what our favorite Godzilla films were.
You're surprised I didn't ask you the most obvious question? Bill, you have not watched this show enough. Bill, what's your favorite Godzilla movie?
my favorite is the 1964 Mothra versus Godzilla.
Oof, that's a, yeah.
I think I think the best one is the original one, but my favorite one is Mothra versus Godzilla. I think it's got a great pace. It's got great payoff. It's got twin 30 centimeter tall girls that sing, giant moth, giant caterpillars. The best Godzilla design in my opinion. And I'm one of the best scores. I don't know. It just works for me.
Nice. Well, that's having an anniversary too. I'll have to watch that.
Oh yeah, Mothra versus Godzilla. Oh yeah, that is this year, isn't it? 60 years.
60. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a hard call. I'm not sure if I have a real favorite outside of the original. I'd say Destroy All Monsters. I really enjoyed, mostly because of that was one of the first times I had seen something like that with so many big monsters fighting at once, and being a lover at that point when I saw it, when I finally saw that film. Because I had seen it, because in our library in elementary school, we had a book, a Godzilla book, and there was a still from a promo still from Destroy All Monsters that had like eight monsters in it, including Godzilla. And that, and I'm like, what movie is this? I must find this. And it took me forever. And then once I saw it, I that was one of those to where, you know, people are used to like crossovers and all kinds of things now. Wasn't a big thing with, you know, back then, you know, where you had so many back and forth. Yeah, you had a return of a monster occasionally in these films, but not that many at once fighting. And yeah, I really dug that one. And that was one of the first ones where I was just like, mind was blown. So many of these monsters they put in, because I was young when I watched it, so I didn't know anything about licensing. And oh yeah, these are all Toho films, where I'm just like, holy crap, there's all these monsters fighting Godzilla. This is awesome.
Well, now I got to watch both these movies. So yeah. Thanks for the recommendations.
But he's right. Yeah. He's right about Mothra versus Godzilla. That's just a gorgeous film, really, for a monster film. It's
you should check out the 4K restorations that Toho has done on those films. They make the Criterion discs look.
I'm gonna have to now with your recommendation. I wasn't sure on it, but yeah, I gotta check those out.
Where can you get those, Bill?
Japan.
Yeah.
Well, I ordered them through Amazon Japan. Yeah. And they sent them right to my house.
And they're just region free, I guess.
Blu-ray has the same region as the United States, for Japan and the United States, and I think some other Asian countries. So they play just. I don't have a 4K machine, so I just ordered the Blu-rays, and yeah, they're just blown away. I've got like four of them.
Nice.
Which I may wait for until they release Mysterians, and then I'm going to be I'm going to get an airplane and go over there and go to pick it up.
Yeah, you won't have to make a special trip, I'm sure. You've been known to visit Japan, Bill. All right. Well, I'm going to let you guys go now. Thanks for hanging out and talking about giant monsters. And yeah, we'll be back at some point. I don't know what we're doing next week, if anything, but whenever that is, whatever that is, thanks very much for watching Kicking the Seat. This has been Gojira X Godzilla King of the Monsters. Thank you very much. Take care. And I don't have a giant monster roar, so I'm just going to say...
Sorry.
No.